and welcome to Greatest Britons. Today's Greatest Briton is one of my favourites. This is one that you should be able to talk about to anybody that runs down the British Empire or says that the people involved in the British Empire were nasty, racist colonialists. This is a perfect example of what the members of the British Empire used to be like. Today's episode is in honour of Major General Charles Gordon. And of course, your hosts for the episode are myself, Sven Longshanks, and Max Musson from Western Spring. Well, shall we get into our Greatest Briton then, Max? I'm quite keen to get into this week.
Yes, let's do that.
Yeah, it's our Greatest Briton for this week is Charles George Gordon. And I came across him completely by surprise, just looking through, trying to find interesting people to do with the British Empire. And I think this one is absolutely fantastic. There's so much in this story. There's media manipulation, there's propaganda, there's an Islamic state, if you can believe that. The guy himself is really looking out for the best interests of the foreigners that he is among. He really does set a good example of what an officer in the British Empire was really like. He was against slavery. It shows you how barbaric the Chinese were and how we were really bringing them civilization. And he was really charitable as well. He liked to look after the poor kids that didn't have any education. And he gave away most of his money, actually, to charity. I mean, this was a really, really virtuous man. There's been a film made of him as well. It's called Khartoum, which is just to do with when he was actually in Khartoum and the Siege of Khartoum, and that he was played by Charlton Heston in that. And he was a huge hero to the British people as well. He certainly earns the title of a greatest Briton. Well, let's have a look at what happened to him. We'll have a brief summary of his life, first of all. Major General Charles George Gordon, CB, born 28th of January 1833, died 26th of January 1885, also known as Chinese Gordon, Gordon Pasha, and Gordon of Khartoum, was a British Army officer and administrator. He saw action in the Crimean War as an officer in the British Army. However, he made his military reputation in China, where he was placed in command of the Ever Victorious Army, a force of Chinese soldiers led by European officers. In the early 1860s, Gordon and his men were instrumental in putting down the Taiping Rebellion, regularly defeating much larger forces. For these accomplishments, he was given the nickname Chinese Gordon and honours from both the Emperor of China and the British. He entered the service of the Khedive of Egypt in 1873 with British government approval and later became the Governor General of the Sudan, where he did much to suppress revolts and the local slave trade. Exhausted, he resigned and returned to Europe in 1880. A serious revolt then broke out in the Sudan, led by a Muslim fanatic religious leader and self-proclaimed Mahdi, Muhammad Ahmed. In early 1884, Gordon was sent to Khartoum with instructions to secure the evacuation of loyal soldiers and civilians and to depart with them. But in defiance of those instructions, after evacuating about 2,500 civilians, he retained a smaller group of soldiers and non-military men. In the build-up to battle, the two leaders corresponded, each attempting to convert the other to his faith, but neither would accede. And Gordon was actually put up as this Christ figure that was fighting against these Islamic devils as well. It really captured the imagination of the British public when this was going on. Besieged by the Mahdi's forces, Gordon then organised a citywide defence lasting almost a year that gained him the admiration of the British public, but not of the government, which had wished him not to become entrenched. Only when public pressure to act had become irresistible did the government, with reluctance, send a relief force. But unfortunately, it arrived 2 days after the city had fallen and Gordon had been killed. Well, that's a summary of what happens, and we'll get into the details of this as we go. But have you got any comments you'd like to make on that introduction, Max?
Just really, in that brief introduction, we've already raised the issue of Gordon not necessarily following his orders to the letter. Now, I don't know whether he had initially been instructed not to defend Khartoum and that he had decided to defend Khartoum in defiance of those orders, or whether his orders were to evacuate the the civilians, and he had then decided that in addition to evacuating the civilians, he would defend the city in the absence of any further instructions. And that's perhaps something that as we go through, more information will come to light. But I think that is a central aspect of Gordon's personality that is one of the things that made him popular amongst the public. The fact that he was a little bit of a what's the word I'm trying to think of here?
He was acting on his own initiative.
That's right, acting on his own initiative. Yes, definitely
acting on his own initiative a lot of the time. And yeah, the British public really did warm to him because of that. Well, let's start with his early life. Gordon was born in Woolwich, London, a son of Major General Henry William Gordon and Elizabeth Enderby Gordon. The men of the Gordon family had served as officers in the British Army for four generations. And as a son of a general, Gordon was brought up to be the fifth generation. The possibility that Gordon would pursue anything other than a military career seems never to have been considered by his parents. And all of Gordon's brothers also became officers in the army. So this was still a time when you would do the same thing that your parents did. And therefore, each generation would get better at what they were doing because they would learn from a child what they were going to be doing as an adult. I think this was a much better way of doing things than we have now when people do different things to their parents and they have temping jobs. I mean, this is a time when you went into a trade and you had that trade for the whole of your life and your children were taught to be brought up in that trade as well. And there was a lot more security in that, I think. Well, as a teenager and an army cadet, Gordon was known for his high spirits, a combative streak, and a tendency to disregard authority and the rules if he felt them to be stupid or unjust, a personality trait that held back his graduation by 2 years when teachers decided to punish him for flouting the rules. As an officer, Gordon showed strong charisma and leadership, but his superiors distrusted him on account of his tendency to disobey orders if he felt them to be wrong or unjust. A man of medium stature with striking blue eyes, the charismatic Gordon had the ability to inspire men to follow him anywhere. And there's quite a lot of mention of these striking blue eyes that he had. Everybody that met him mentioned that. And also about the fact that he was a highly moral man. If he felt something wasn't right, then he was just not going to do it. I mean, this man really did set a good example of being a charitable white man, basically. Wherever he went, everybody said this man just set the absolute perfect example of how a man should be. Do you want to comment on this, Max?
I think what you've said there sets the scene for what we're going to cover later. I think that, as I said earlier on, that Gordon has already been identified and from what you've just said, identified again as somebody who is a bit of a maverick. I think that's something that people do find an attractive quality in people. They don't like people who slavishly follow orders. I much prefer somebody who is their own person and who has perhaps a bit of colour to their personality introduces a bit of daring do into their lives.
I'm not sure if he actually purchased any of his promotions either. I think he earned most of his promotions. And I guess the fact that his family and all the generations of his family had been in the army as well, I'm sure that would have stood him in good stead. Anyway, people would have recognized his name and that he was from this family. Unlike the one that we covered last week, where he started from absolutely nothing and made his way up to being the governor general. Well, let's have a look at the Crimea here. In the 19th century, Russia was Britain's arch enemy, with many people in both nations seeing an ideological conflict between Russian autocracy and British democracy, and Gordon was anxious to fight in the Crimea. He was put to work in the siege of Sevastopol and took part in the assault of the Redan from the 18th of June to the 8th of September 1855. As a sapper, Gordon had to map out the Russian fortifications at the city fortress of Sevastopol, designed by the famous Russian military engineer Edward Totleben, a highly dangerous job that frequently put him under enemy fire and led to him being wounded for the first time when a Russian sniper put a bullet into him. On the 18th of June 1855, the besieging British and French armies began what was intended to be the final assault that would take Sevastopol, which began with a huge bombardment. As a sapper, Gordon was in a front-line trench where he was under intense fire. Men fell all around him and he was forced to take cover so often that he was covered literally from head to toe with mud and blood. He would spend 34 consecutive days in the trenches around Sevastopol and earned a reputation as an able and brave young officer. And it was said at the British HQ that if you want to know what the Russians are up to, send for Charlie Gordon. So he's already making a name for himself here, and we can see what it was like. I mean, this was really gritty work in the trenches here, and he'd taken on a particularly dangerous job. He was really fearless. In actual fact, later on in his life, we learned that he never actually carried any weapons. He would just carry a rattan cane. And he really sort of trusted in the Lord that he would protect him, sort of thing. And he was known for this. Yet at the same time, you know, he's got this reputation as being an able, brave young officer. And he's willing to take all these risks. Very, very courageous. I don't really know that much about the Crimean War. I mean, they say here there was this ideological conflict between Russian autocracy and British democracy. I think what they really mean there is the Russian monarchy, because Russia was a monarchy, and Britain was a constitutional monarchy. So it wasn't really autocracy.
I think that there was a bit of conflict between the Russians and the British, particularly in terms of extending colonies into Central Asia, because the Russians were moving into Afghanistan and those kind of regions and down through the Caucasus at the same time that we were active in India and pushing the boundaries of the British Empire north. But also there was a certain amount of support given by the British government initially to the Ottoman Empire, who were also trying to resist the expansion of the Russian Empire. And obviously the Russians were trying to resist the expansion of the Ottoman Empire as well. And so that was kind of like the background to it. If you think about this situation, the besieging of Sevastopol was in 1855, so it's just under 60 years prior to the First World War, and already you can see with the use of trenches, etc., that the kind of warfare that we saw during the First World War was already developing during the Crimean War.
Well, that's interesting you say there about the Ottomans, because it becomes apparent later on that he's sort of working with the Ottomans. So the British were working with the Ottomans because the Ottomans were against the Russians and against the Russian encroachment on their lands. And of course, it was the Russians that actually helped to defeat the Ottomans in Bulgaria and freed Bulgaria. And I think some of these other European countries that had actually been under a Muslim occupation for some years. Well, for his service in the Crimea, he received the Crimean War Medal and Clasp. For the same service, he was appointed a Chevalier of the Legion of Honour by the government of France on the 16th of July 1856. And following the peace, he was attached to an international commission to mark the new border between the Russian Empire and the Ottoman Empire in Bessarabia. During time spent delineating the frontier between Ottoman Armenia and Russian Armenia, the highlight of which was tobogganing down Mount Ararat, Gordon continued surveying, mapping, and embraced the new technology of the camera to take what the Canadian historian C. Brad Fout called a series of evocative photographs of the people and landscape of Armenia. Throughout his life, Gordon was always a keen amateur photographer and was elected a fellow of the Royal Geographical Society to honour him for his Armenian photographs. He returned to Britain in late 1858 and was appointed as an instructor at Chatham before being promoted to captain on the 1st of April, 1859. So we can see there that it's not all work and no play. He's going tobogganing here. He's also taken up this hobby of photography, which he is very good at, and he's involved in mapping and delineating these new borders that came about after the end of the war here. And we also see that he's been given awards by France because France was obviously must have been part of the Allies there that were fighting in the Crimean War, I would guess, as well as the Ottomans. Do you want to comment on any of this, Max?
Yeah, from what you say, Gordon was a very likable person, a very charismatic person, and part of that would have been him having a wide interest in things beyond just mere soldiering. So, you know, although he was somebody who was sent out to help to expand and secure the British Empire, he was also at the same time taking an interest in the peoples of the areas that he occupied, or that his troops occupied, and was looking upon his duties from a scientific perspective as well, in terms of his membership of the Royal Geographical Society.
Yeah, it's very important that as well, that he took an interest in the peoples that they were occupying. He really sympathised with them and really tried to make life for them better than it was, which we will see. You know, we get this narrative today that the British Empire was all about occupying and oppressing these people and taking what we could from them. And it's just not true. The absolute opposite of that is true. If Gordon is any example, and I think he is a good example of what the people would have been like that were involved in it. They saw these other races that they were occupying as just people that were a little bit behind us, and we were there to help them on the way to civilization and democracy, and once we had got there they could be given the rule of their democracies themselves and run their countries themselves, and that is eventually what happened after the Second World War. Well, next we get to China. Now, Gordon was intensely bored with garrison duty in Chatham, and he often wrote to the War Office, begging them to send him anywhere in the world where British arms were seeing action. And in 1860, Gordon got his wish by volunteering to serve in China during the Second Opium War. When he arrived in Hong Kong, he was disappointed to learn he was just too late for the fighting. Gordon had heard of the Taiping Rebellion long before he had set sail for China, and he was at first sympathetic towards the Taipings, who were led by the charismatic madman Hong Jiquang, who proclaimed himself to be the younger brother of Jesus Christ. And Gordon viewed them as somewhat eccentric Christians. And Gordon was also a Christian. He was a Protestant Christian, but he had his own views about it. He wasn't really part of any denomination, but he was definitely a Christian. After stopping in Shanghai, Gordon visited the Chinese countryside and was appalled at the atrocities committed by the Taipings against the local peasants, writing to his family that he would love to smash this cruel army with its desolating presence that killed without mercy. He arrived at Tianjin in September 1860 and was present at the occupation of Beijing and at the destruction of the Summer Palace. And the destruction of the Summer Palace was actually by us. Gordon agreed with Lord Elgin that after the Chinese had killed a group of British and French officers travelling under a white flag to Pali, that a reprisal was in order. But they called the burning of the beautiful Summer Palace vandal-like, and he told his sister in a letter it made one's heart sore to incinerate it. And I'll just stop there because that reminds me of Flavius Josephus, and when he is talking about the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. It weren't the Jews that were upset, it was the Romans, and there were tears in the Romans' eyes while this temple was being destroyed, because it was such a magnificent piece of architecture. And you got the same thing going on here. The British feel terrible about doing this, but there had to be reprisals because these savages had killed the British and French officers who were travelling under a white flag to a peace conference. So there had to be a reprisal. And it gives you an idea of what these people were like. And the British were there to keep law and order, not, you know, oppressing these people, but protecting them from these savage Taipings, who he called a cruel army with a desolating presence. Do you want to comment on that, Max?
No, I think actually you've said about all that can usefully be said there. It is clear that... Gordon has, as we've already established, got this wider concern than just mere soldiering. You know, if he was just involved in soldiering, he wouldn't really be that worried about the destruction of cultural icons in the way that the Summer Palace was. And he wouldn't really be that bothered about the cruelty being inflicted by one tribal group in China against another tribal group. But the very fact that he was concerned about these things shows that his regards for the work that he, or his regard for the work that he had to do, was much wider than as I say, just mere soldiering, and he was saw himself in a kind of humanitarian role.
Yeah, so what he was doing there was protecting the people, not oppressing the people. When they got to Jiangsu province, Staveley was requested to appoint a British officer to command the contingent, and he selected Gordon, who had been made a brevet major in December 1862, with the nomination being approved by the British government. Given the former officer, Burgervine's alcoholism, open corruption, and tendency to engage in acts of mindless violence when drunk, the Chinese wanted a man of good temper, of clean hands, and a steady economist as his replacement. These requirements led Staveley to choose Gordon. Lee, the governor of the province, was impressed with Gordon, writing, "It is a direct blessing from heaven, the coming of this British Gordon. He is superior in manner and bearing to any of the foreigners whom I have come into contact with, and does not show outwardly that conceit which makes most of them repugnant in my sight. What an elixir for a heavy heart to see this splendid Englishman fight. If there is anything that I admire nearly as much as the superb scholarship of Zheng Guofan, it is the military qualities of this fine officer. He is a glorious fellow, with his many faults, his pride, his temper, and his never-ending demand for money, but he is a noble man, and in spite of all I have said to him or about him, I will ever think most highly of him. He is an honest man, but difficult to get on with." So he's been quite fair there, because he's also pointing out some of these negative things as well, his temper, his pride. And I don't understand this, his never-ending demand for money, though, because we will see later on that it's the opposite of that, really. Perhaps he was giving some of that away to charity.
Perhaps he was just making demands for money to finance the further, to finance his future expeditions, etc.
Well, actually, I think it was to finance the troops.
Yeah.
I think it was probably to finance the troops. Gordon was honest and incorruptible, and unlike many Chinese officers, did not steal the money that was meant to pay his men, but rather insisted on paying the ever-victorious army on time and in full. Gordon's insistence on paying his men meant that he was always pressing the imperial government for money, something which often irritated the mandarins, who did not understand why Gordon did not just let his men loot and plunder as a compensation for wages, like the Chinese did. Gordon quickly won the respect of his troops and made a point of treating prisoners of war well in order to encourage the Taipings to surrender. And many of his men were actually former Taipings who had chosen to enlist in the ever-victorious army. So again, we see here that he's got a much better reputation than the actual Chinese. And the Chinese were just looting and plundering, whereas Gordon wouldn't have that, and he wouldn't allow any of his men to do that. And the Chinese officers were annoyed at that, because it meant they had to actually pay wages. So he sets a good example. Do you want to add anything?
Well, it's just that I think that it is this this decline in the values of Chinese society that made China vulnerable to the expansion of Western nations during this period. I think if you go back in history and you look at the Chinese civilization, you can go back 2,000 or 3,000 years, and you can find instances where really superb engineering works were undertaken by the Chinese, which some of which were later copied by Europeans when they first visited China, and it's clear from all of the cultural trappings, the music, etc., and the forms of dance that exist in the East, that the Chinese were a culture-bearing race, and they had invented gunpowder before it was known about in Europe, but unfortunately just used the gunpowder for making fireworks to amuse children with, rather than using it for martial purposes. And you know what is described here of Chinese officers keeping the money that was that should have been used to pay their men, and then just letting their men loot and pillage, that illustrates the kind of decadence that had overtaken Chinese society, that weakened it and made it therefore, as I say, vulnerable to Western expansion.
Do you think maybe when they were at the height of it, that was around the time of Marco Polo?
Yes, certainly, yeah, that's right. And so one of the lessons of history basically is that if you have a large empire and you then turn away from the values and the principles that created that empire, and you allow the empire then to descend into decadence, that your empire then becomes ripe for other outside groups to take advantage of, and to an extent that's what we're seeing as far as Britain is concerned, as a result of us giving away the British Empire, and what other European countries are seeing as a result of allowing their empires to be lost as well, and once the empires have gone, then the countries which were the fountain of inspiration for those empires, those countries then become decadent, and we see all of the sort of things that we're seeing today in Britain and in Europe that are destructive as far as our nation is concerned. There is a lesson that we didn't learn from the Chinese, and that we need to learn very quickly now.
Yeah, I think if the men from the British Empire could see the state of Britain today, they would be so shocked that all these sort of things are going on, that when they went out in the British Empire, they went out to India and China and the rest of these places to prevent these things from happening. And I think he's really showing true British values here, a just day's pay for a just day's work, and sticking to what's right and what's just, rather than looting and pillaging. And Gordon was quite critical of the way Chinese generals fought the war, observing that the Chinese were willing to inflict and accept gargantuan losses in battle, an approach Gordon disapproved of, writing, "The great thing is to cut off their retreat, and the chances are they will go without trouble, but attack them in the front and leave their rear open, and they fight most desperately." Gordon always preferred to outflank the Taiping lines rather than to take them on frontally, an approach that caused much tension with his counterparts in the Chinese Imperial Army, who did not share Gordon's horror at the huge numbers of dead caused by frontal assaults. So Gordon's got more care for his men than the Chinese Imperial Army did for their men. And a lot of this army, this ever-victorious army, they were the Chinese. So Gordon, the white British man, has actually got more care for the Chinese than the leaders of the Chinese Imperial Army have. In its last years, the Taiping movement had oppressed the Chinese peasantry, and during a final battle where Gordon appeared on an armoured paddle steamer armed with a 32-pound cannon on the bow and followed by a fleet of 80 junks converted to gunboats, Chinese peasants emerged from their homes to cut down and hack to death the fleeing Taipings, and Gordon was hailed as a liberator by the ordinary Chinese people. So we see this: it wasn't just the leaders of the army that were like this, it was the Chinese peasantry as well. You know, they hacked all these people to death as soon as they had the chance. They're quite savage. The ever-victorious army was entirely a mercenary force whose only loyalty was to money, and whose men were interested in fighting only in order to gain the chance to plunder. Gordon felt very uncomfortable commanding this force, and at one point had to order the summary execution of one of his officers when the latter tried to take the ever-victorious army over to the Taipings, who had offered a generous bribe for switching sides. Gordon had to impose strict discipline on the ever-victorious army and worked hard to prevent the army from engaging in its tendency to loot and mistreat civilians. the mercenaries of the ever-victorious army, comprising some of the worst social elements of China, Britain, and the United States, were notorious for this practice. Whenever they marched into a new district, they would steal everything while raping all the women, leading Gordon to ensure that those officers accused of looting and or rape were summarily shot. He also had the pleasure of defeating Burgervine, the former officer who Gordon replaced, whom Gordon detested, who had raised a mercenary force and joined the Taipings. After Gordon had surrounded Burgervine's force outside of Suzhou, the latter had abandoned his own men and attempted to rejoin the Imperial side, leading Gordon to arrest him and send him to the American consul in Shanghai, together with a letter asking that Burgervine be expelled from China. Surprised he didn't have him summarily shot. Do you want to add comments to that, Max?
Well, yeah, I'm surprised he didn't have him summarily shot as well. Yeah, I mean, this is really a continuation of the last point you made, really, where Gordon is exhibiting the finest traits of the British nation, and it's where, you know, had he been somebody who was just motivated by his own glory, you could almost imagine him in a situation where he could lead the ever victorious army to a final victory and declare himself the king of China or something like that, because he's the sort of man who is exhibiting the kind of characteristics that one would hope to see in a monarch, and I think that is why the troops followed him and felt better disposed towards him than they did their own Chinese leaders, and why the Chinese peasants, when they were being liberated from the Taipings, also had that same point of view.
Yeah, a lot of charisma and bravery. He cared about his people. He just set a really good example. As Gordon travelled up and down the Yangtze River Valley, he was appalled by the scenes of poverty and suffering he saw, writing in a letter to his sister, "The horrible furtive looks of the wretched inhabitants hovering around one's boats haunts me, and the knowledge of their want of nourishment would sicken anyone. They are like wolves. The dead lie where they fall and are in some cases trodden quite flat by passers-by." The suffering of the Chinese people strengthened Gordon's faith, as he argued that there had to be a just, loving God who would one day redeem humanity from all this wretchedness and misery. During his time in China, Gordon was well known and respected by friend and foe alike for leading from the front and going into battle armed only with his rattan cane. Gordon always refused to carry a gun or a sword, a choice of weapon that almost cost him his life several times. Gordon's bravery in battle, his string of victories, apparent immunity to bullets, and his intense, blazing blue eyes led many Chinese to believe that Gordon had supernatural powers and had harnessed the Qi, the mystical life force traditionally believed in China, to govern everything in some extraordinary way. So again, we can see just what a state these Chinese people are in. Wretched inhabitants, the dead lie where they fall, they need nourishing, they're in a terrible state, and the British feelings towards that is, we want to help these people, we want to protect them from whatever it is that's causing this, we want to bring these people civilization, we want to bring them trade. Don't forget, this is during the Opium Wars as well, so we're selling this opium to these Chinese, but the people that were actually doing that and forcing the opium on the Chinese were like this guy Gordon here, you know, just wanting the best for them and wanting them to have the benefit of trade and the benefit of civilization. Do you want to comment on his description of the Chinese here, Max?
Well, not necessarily his description of the Chinese, more probably the description of the description of him by the Chinese, the fact that they felt he had harnessed the Qi, and that's what one would expect, where you have people who've perhaps been raised in ignorance and who then suddenly see somebody who is who so fulsomely exhibits the qualities of a monarch. It's also interesting the fact that he never carried a gun or a sword. The sort of rattan cane is I would assume would have been what would have been described at the time as a swagger stick, A lot of British Army officers used to carry it as a short stick that was a bit shorter than a walking stick, but superficially looked a bit like a walking stick, which was called a swagger stick. And these are kind of symbolic of the mace that a king would carry, a mace. And obviously the queen has a mace that she held in her hand when she was crowned. Also other people that in positions of authority would have a mace, handed to them. But obviously for everyday use, the mace wouldn't be a large ornate thing that made of gold or something of that sort, which would be very heavy and difficult to carry around. But the stick would be more symbolic. And so, as I say, army officers used to carry these swagger sticks around that they, you know, presumably could use to strike somebody with, but it would be more for shock value than for anything else.
And more a symbol of his authority. That's right. This is the main man. Treat him with respect. He's not somebody that you want to shoot. And if you take him prisoner, he needs to be treated well as an officer and all the rest of it. Because even when you're fighting against another army, you have the respect for your enemy. If he's a formidable foe, you have respect for him. And this is the man leading them. And like a mace or a scepter, like the royal scepter that he was carrying there.
Yes.
Well, Gordon then reorganized his force and advanced against Kunshan, which was captured at considerable loss, before also capturing the city of Suzhou in November. After its surrender, Gordon personally guaranteed that any Taiping rebel who laid down his arms would be humanely treated. But the ever-victorious army had been ordered not to enter Suzhou, and only imperial forces entered the city. Gordon was thus powerless when the imperial forces executed all of the Taiping POWs, an act that enraged him. A furious Gordon wrote that executing prisoners of war was stupid, writing, "If faith had been kept, there would have been no more fighting, as every town would have given in." In China, the penalty for rebellion was death, and under the Chinese system of familial responsibility, all family members of a rebel were equally guilty, even if they had nothing to do with the rebellious individual's acts. The Mandarins were thus much inclined to execute not only Taipings, but also their spouses, children, parents, and siblings, as being all equally guilty of treason. Gordon believed this approach was militarily counterproductive, as it encouraged the Taipings to fight to the death, which Gordon felt to be very unwise, as the Taiping leader, Hong Jiquan, had become murderously paranoid, conducting bloody purges of his followers. Many Taipings were willing to surrender, if only the imperial government would spare the lives of themselves and their families. Even more importantly, Gordon had given his word of honour that all of the Taipings who surrendered would be well treated, and he regarded the massacre as a stain on his honour. Again, we can see that these are really savage peoples, really, killing the spouses, the children, the parents, and the siblings. They're all guilty, equally guilty of treason. This is the sort of thing that was going on. This is what these people were like. And the British were over there to prevent this. And also,
what it also shows, though, is that the Imperial Chinese were little better, really, than the Taipings. Because of their sort of murderous tendency in this sort of situation, where a desire for revenge outweighs the good sense that Gordon exhibited in stating that if you allow people to surrender under those circumstances and you treat them well once they've surrendered, then it will encourage more people to, and more among the Taipings to surrender as well, which would then make the overall job much easier. And that once you conduct a massacre of people, then you know that any future Taipings in a similar situation are going to fight to the bitter end.
Not very good at strategy, were they, this Chinese Imperial Army? They just wanted a full frontal assault. We don't care how many people are killed, and we're not interested in strategy at all. So you can see why Gordon was such a difference to the rest. And I can understand he would have been really, really furious at that they had not honoured his pledge. I mean, he had made promise.
But this again is a feature of what happens when empires become decadent, where people who are totally unfit for authority get appointed to positions of authority based upon cronyism and things of that sort, and therefore do things that are just totally illogical and counterproductive.
That's what
we see in Britain today with the handling of the coronavirus.
Yeah, it's a serious thing, you know, an oath as well. And he had given them his oath, and the Chinese weren't prepared to respect that. But on the 1st of January 1864, Gordon was informed that a messenger from the Tongzhi Emperor was coming to see him, and that he should put on his finest uniform. When the Emperor's messenger arrived, he had with him servants carrying boxes of silver coins, numbering 10,000 in total, together with banners written in the most eloquent calligraphy, celebrating Gordon as a great general, and a letter from the Emperor himself, written in the best calligraphy on yellow silk, thanking Gordon for taking Suzhou and offering all these presents as rewards. Gordon refused all the gifts, and wrote on the Emperor's silk message, "Major Gordon receives the approbation of His Majesty the Emperor with every gratification, but regrets most sincerely that owing to the circumstances which occurred since the capture of Suzhou, he is unable to receive any mark of His Majesty the Emperor's recognition." The Emperor was much offended when he received Gordon's message at the Forbidden City, and Gordon's military career in China was then effectively over for a time. During his time with the ever-victorious army, Gordon had won 33 battles in succession, but wrote a letter home that his losses were no joke, as 48 of his 100 officers and about 1,000 of the 3,500 soldiers had been killed or wounded in action. So he's really a man of his word here. He's not going to take a bribe from the Emperor to back down on this. You know, killing those prisoners of war after he had given his word, that was just not on. And again, I think this is an example of British fiber, British values, isn't it? These are real British values. You know, not taking a bribe and setting an example like this. We should probably leave it here, but I'll just ask you, you know, have you got anything else that you'd like to add to this before we finish, Max?
No, just to repeat what you've just said, really, that this is this sort of rigorous standing on matters of principle is one of the things that made people like Gordon stand out from the people around them.
Well, it's something that made Britain stand out, isn't it? That's what Britain was known for sticking to principles and keeping to their word. There was a time when we had a very, very good reputation throughout the world, particularly throughout the Third World. Not that you would believe it today with the people that attack the British Empire and run it down. We've got some more on our greatest Britons to get into. Major General Charles George Gordon that we began last week. And we'll start with a little recap of where we got to. We talked about his early life, how he was the son of a general. He was the fifth generation of military men. So it ran in his family, being in the military. We talked about how he fought in the trenches of the Crimea. And he was noted for his bravery there. And then he went to China, where he led the ever-victorious army, which was a group of mercenaries, pretty much. And he was absolutely appalled by the Chinese atrocities that he saw there on both sides, on the Taiping Rebellion and also from the Imperial Army. And General Gordon actually had people shot for looting, and the Chinese didn't want to actually pay the troops. They just wanted to let them loot and pillage and rampage. And Gordon was really disgusted at this, and he wanted to take prisoners of war, and he wanted to treat the prisoners of war well. And he gave his oath that if any of the Taiping gave themselves up, they would not be massacred. And instead, when the Taiping gave themselves up, they were all massacred, along with all their families, their wives, their children. And Gordon was absolutely furious at this. And the Emperor tried to give him a reward, and he snubbed the Emperor. And his military career in China was then effectively over for a time. And during his time with the ever-victorious army, Gordon had won 33 battles in succession, but had written a letter home that his losses were no joke, as 48 of his 100 officers and about 1,000 of 3,500 soldiers had been killed or wounded in action, which he took as being a very bad thing. Do you want to add anything to that recap? You got any comments you want to make on that, Max?
Only that you know, what we discussed last week about Gordon sets him out as being somebody who is an archetypal European leader, and somebody who is of a charismatic disposition, and somebody who is honourable to a fault.
Oh, he's definitely the British archetype of keeping your word and doing things properly and putting other people first. And he really took that seriously, as we will see. Well, the Emperor did eventually promote Gordon, and he promoted him to the rank of Chief Commander of Jiangsu Province, which was a title equal to Field Marshal. He decorated him with the Imperial Yellow Jacket and raised him to King's Viscount First Class. But Gordon declined an additional gift of 10,000 pieces of silver from the Imperial Treasury. Only 40 men were allowed to wear the Yellow Jacket, which was the Emperor's ceremonial bodyguard, and it was thus a signal honour for Gordon to be allowed to wear it. The British Army promoted Gordon to Lieutenant Colonel on the 16th of February 1864, and he was appointed a Companion of the Order of the Bath on the 9th of December 1864. And that's to do with being knighted, I think, the Order of the Bath. The traders of Shanghai offered Gordon huge sums of money to thank him for his work commanding the ever-victorious army, but Gordon declined all honours of financial gain, writing, "I know I shall leave China as poor as I entered it, but with the knowledge that through my weak instrumentality upwards of 80 to 100,000 lives have been spared, I want no further satisfaction than this." The British journalist Mark Urban wrote, "People saw a brave man who acted with humanity in an otherwise ghastly conflict, standing out from the other mercenaries, adventurers and cutthroats in wanting almost nothing for himself." In a leader in August 1864, the Times wrote about Gordon, "The part of the soldier of fortune is in these days very difficult to play with honour, but if ever the actions of a soldier fighting in foreign service ought to be viewed with indulgence and even with admiration, this exceptional tribute is due to Colonel Gordon." The savage Taiping Rebellion, which was the bloodiest war of the entire 19th century, taking somewhere between 20 and 30 million lives, is largely forgotten in the West today. But at the time, the civil war in China attracted much media attention in the West, and Gordon's command of the ever-victorious army received much coverage from British newspapers, and this is where Gordon gained his popular nickname of Chinese Gordon. So we see there that he's refusing to take the coin from the traders as well. And don't forget, this was the Opium War as well. So Gordon is in this to try and do his best for his country. He's in it to try and save as many lives as possible. He is not in this for the money. And I think we can detect here that he's not too impressed with the traders and the merchants, because he didn't want to take their money. He could have taken their money and he could have given it to charity, but he just didn't want to take it at all. And in the same way, he refused to take the coin from the emperor as well, because the emperor had broken his oath. And we can see here that he's becoming extremely popular with the British, and he's being lionized in the newspapers for this attitude that he has. And the fact that he is lionized for this, and he was huge in the newspapers, says that this is the sort of mentality that the British people had, and they wanted to see people like that. They wanted to see people being really good. They weren't interested in gossip and adultery and sleaze. They were interested in learning about really virtuous British men that set a really good example within the British Empire and within the other countries that Britain was trading with. So it tells us something about the British public back at home, as well as about this very virtuous man. Do you want to add any comments there, Max?
Well, just that the Opium Wars are very often portrayed as being an ignoble period of British history, where we apparently, and I don't know the full ins and outs of the Opium Wars, but where certain British interests represented in China were involved in the opium trade, and I don't doubt that that may be the case. But what Gordon's life and Gordon's time in China teaches us is that wasn't what the British public were expecting of our troops in and our representatives in China. And as far as Gordon is concerned, you know, he was somebody who stood apart from any corruption of that sort, and was somebody who was motivated by the highest human ideals.
And we have to be careful not to project our own ideals from today 150 years ago as to what was happening at this time. I mean, we would look at opium today, we would look at it as an addictive drug, it's this terrible thing. It's probably only as addictive as tobacco. And tobacco sales were also a part of the British Empire. That went on for much longer. And what had happened was the Chinese had agreed to take this opium. That was part of their contract, is they would take a certain amount of opium every year. It would be made in Afghanistan and India. It would then be transported to China, and the Chinese, in exchange for that, they would give the British tea or whatever else it was. And it was just purely seen as trade. And what happened was the Chinese ended up having a serious problem with this opium, and masses of them started getting addicted to it. And you've got to remember, opium was legal everywhere, and it was only in China that they discovered they had this huge problem with it. So, I mean, it was legal back in Britain, and we didn't have this problem with, you know, half the country being addicted to it. That was something that was specific to China, but they had made this contract that they were going to take all this opium, and the British had made all this opium. Okay, it was Sassoon, it was Jewish merchants that were responsible for it. It was their trade, but they were seen as a part of the British Empire, and so our British Army had to go over there, and this Taiping Rebellion formed a part of it. And this was actually the Second Opium War. So not a good thing to go to war about. But we have to be very careful about projecting today's sensibilities onto what was going on back then, because we can see what Gordon was like, and I would say he was probably far more virtuous than most people that are around today. We'll see more of that, in fact, in this next piece. After he arrived in Britain, Gordon announced to the press that he did not want to board the tram of the world, and he asked to be left alone. Following the death of his father, he undertook extensive social work in the town, including teaching at the local ragged school. Before 1870, there was no universal school system in Britain, and the ragged schools were a network of privately funded schools that gave a free education to children whose parents were too poor to afford the school fees. During his time at Gravesend, Gordon was much involved in charity work, trying to ensure that homeless boys he found begging on the street did not go hungry while attempting to find them homes and jobs. Many of the scuttlers, as Gordon fondly called the homeless boys, were taken in by him to live at his home, the Fort House. Outside of the Fort House, there was graffiti written on the wall by one of the evidently less educated boys that read, "God bless the Colonel," spelt with a K. Another scuttler later recalled, "He made me feel, first of all, the meaning of the phrase, the goodness of God. Goodness become to me, through Gordon, the most desirable of ideas. We were under the spell of Gordon's personality. We lived in the magic of his mystery, enchanted." And every year, Gordon actually gave away 90% of his annual income of £3,000, which is equivalent to £333,000 last year, to charity. Chinese Gordon did not enjoy his celebrity status, and though Gordon was extremely charismatic, he only kept a limited circle of friends and found dealing with strangers difficult. A colleague recalled that Gordon's time at Gravesend was the most peaceful and happy of his life, but Gordon was often bored and constantly asking the War Office for an assignment to somewhere dangerous, often speaking nostalgically of his service in China and how he wished he could return to that country. So we can see here that he just wants to help people, really, and he goes to the poorest group in society, the poor boys, and tries to give them an education, helps out at the school, tries to help these kids out, these orphaned kids, finding them work or finding them homes that they can stay in. And we can see that they were very pleased to actually get his help. And I mean, that's a massive amount of his income that he was giving away. 90%.
And unlike modern celebrities, he's welcomed a large number of poor and destitute boys into his home and given them the support that they needed in order to get an education. So it, again, marks him out as an exceptional person.
Yeah, not just an incredible fighter and courageous on the battlefield, but also virtuous to his own people. I think this was to his own people as well that he was doing this. He was giving this money away, and he was helping those that weren't so well off. And one thing that I was thinking the other day, actually, about this, and with the British Empire, one of the things that we've discussed is the way that when we had the British Empire, you could start from absolutely nothing and you could work your way up to being the general of a province. And we've talked about quite a few of these people that started off with absolutely nothing, and then they bought their promotions, and they ended up running parts of India or being the governor general of the whole of India. And all of this was through merit, because the British Empire was built on merit. They didn't have diversity quotas for the poor. They didn't have affirmative action for the poor. They didn't have laws to prevent people from criticizing the poor. Everything was done on merit, and the British Empire was really proud of that fact, that we had this system where people could basically go up the classes. They could work their way up the classes. If they showed they had merit and they showed they had those skills, they could do that. And then because we now have multiculturalism, we've imported all these other peoples from the world, and they don't seem to be able to do that. They did not seem to be able to function within our system of merit. So now we've had to bring in all these other things that we have, all the diversity quotas and the rest of it. And that, to me, it says that these diversity quotas are wrong. We had the perfect system with the British Empire. People could work their way up through the classes. And the fact that the non-whites that we have here now couldn't shows me that they are completely different to us, because we had a meritorious system. Do you want to comment on that, Max?
No, I think you said what you said there is just about says it all.
Well, let's get into his marriage now and some modern slurs, because Gordon never actually married and is not known to have had a sexual or romantic relationship with anyone, claiming that his army service and frequent travels to dangerous places made it impossible for him to marry, as he was a dead man walking who could only hurt a potential wife, as it was inevitable that he would die in battle. And I believe Cecil Rhodes said similar as well, and when we discussed him.
Yes.
The British historian Dennis Judd writes, like two other great imperial heroes of his time, Kitchener and Cecil Rhodes, Gordon was a celibate. The repression of Gordon's sexual instincts helped to release a flood of celibate energy, which drove him into weird beliefs, eccentric activities, and a sometimes misplaced confidence in his own judgment. And those are all negative things. I'd also like to say that, you know, it probably made him very creative as well. It encouraged his virtuousness. It encouraged his courage and his energy at wanting to go out and do all these things. The sublimation of the sexual instinct, it's a creative instinct. It creates life. So it's also going to help a person to be creative if they sublimate that sexual instinct, I would have thought. Gordon's charitable work for the boys of Gray's End has led to later accusations in the 20th century that he was a homosexual, but no one at the time suspected Gordon of having sexual relations with the legions of teenage boys living with him at the Fort House, and the claim was first made by Lytton Strachey in his book Eminent Victorians, which his biographer Fout commented says more about Strachey than it actually does about Gordon. Fout maintains that Gordon was a heterosexual whose Christian beliefs led him to maintain his virginity right up to his death, as he believed that sexual intercourse was incompatible with his faith. About the frequent references in Gordon's letters about his need to resist temptation and subdue the flesh, Fout argues that it was women rather than men who were tempting him. The South African minister, Dr. Peter Hammond, also denies that Gordon was a homosexual, citing the numerous statements made by Gordon condemning homosexuality as an abomination, charging that the claim that Gordon was gay was a theory with no foundations in fact. The British historian Paul Mersch suggested that Gordon was not gay, but rather his awkwardness with women was due to Asperger's syndrome, which made it extremely difficult for him to express his feelings for women properly. And I think it's really sad that, you know, they accuse this guy of being homosexual today when he was just extremely charitable to young boys, tried to help young boys. I mean, what does that say? It means that nobody's going to want to help young boys because they might get accused of being homosexual. I mean, at this time, yeah, when it was illegal, you could help young boys. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with doing that. And we should want to help our own kind. We should want to help our own gender. And yeah, I find it disgusting that they accuse him of this. This is something that homosexual activists like to do, isn't it? They like to find great people from our past and then cast these aspersions on them. It's rather similar to the blackface, when they try and tell us that we had black people in our past, and they'll try and change white people in Roman times and what have you, and try and claim that they were black. Well, they do the same with they do the same. Homosexuals do the same and try to claim people from our past as that. So he wasn't married. Do you want to comment on this, Max?
Well, I find it sort of interesting that the people that make these kind of claims are people who generally regard themselves as being progressive or permissive, and in many cases homosexuals themselves. But rather than making this claim in such a way that it would present Gordon in a good light, so that they don't turn around and say, "Oh, Gordon was a homosexual, and he's a shining example of somebody who's gay, who can do good works, and who can is very compassionate towards his people and very compassionate towards children that are destitute, etc." Blah 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 blah. Instead of saying that, they just imply that he was homosexual, and he was probably they tend to imply. And you've not sort of mentioned any evidence in this case, but I've seen it in other cases, tend to imply that his interest in young boys would have been because he was perhaps a covert paedophile or something like that. And so what they do is they assign their own predisposition to the famous person, but do it in such a way that it besmirches their reputation rather than enhances it. And that's one of the things which I think is particularly abhorrent in these kind of accusations.
Yeah, there's no evidence for it whatsoever. Just the fact that he cared for poor boys, basically. And, you know, I agree with the author that said that it says more about Strachey than it does about Gordon. It says more about these homosexual activists, that they are the sort of people that couldn't be trusted around small boys than him. And don't forget, this was in the Victorian times as well, and a lot of people didn't really know anything about sex at all. It was, I've mentioned that before in a book called Are We a Declining Race, which was written specifically about that and the fact that the British people really didn't know very much about sex at all, and that actually drove them on to creating the British Empire because they weren't involving themselves in sex all the time. Well, moving on to his travels, during a visit to Bulgaria, Gordon and his friend Gessy became involved in an incident when a Bulgarian couple told them that their 17-year-old daughter had been abducted into the harem of an Ottoman pasha and asked them to free their daughter. Popular legend has it that Gordon and Gessy broke into the pasha's palace at night to rescue the girl, but the truth is less dramatic. Gordon and Gessy demanded that Ahmed Pasha allow them to meet the girl alone, and their request was granted after much arm twisting. Upon meeting the girl, she confirmed that she had been abducted and wanted to go home. Gordon and Gessy then threatened to go to the British and Italian press if she was not released at once, a threat that proved sufficient to win the girl her freedom. And I find this interesting because this is still going on in Pakistan. I've read numerous newspaper reports of girls, Christian girls, that have been abducted by Muslims and forced to marry Muslims in Pakistan. And because it's a Muslim country, the judges say, well, this is part of Sharia law. And she is now the wife of this Muslim. And these poor Christian girls who don't want to be there, that they've essentially been taken as a sex slave. And what we see here is this was going on in white countries. This was going on in Bulgaria 150 years ago. Bulgaria was under Muslims. It was under the Ottomans. Awesome. And this was the sort of thing they would do. They would just kidnap these women along with the boys they would take to turn into Janissaries. And now, of course, we have the grooming gangs today. So I think there's similarities with that. Do you want to comment on that, Max?
No, I think your interpretation is pretty sound.
I'll be interested to know, because we have some Bulgarian listeners, one in particular that uses the chat room, and I'd be interested to know if he had actually heard of this, Gordon's visit to Bulgaria, because maybe it's the sort of thing that becomes a part of the legends or the stories of Bulgaria, that there was this British guy that actually rescued this Bulgarian woman from one of the Muslims. Well, Gordon was promoted to colonel on the 16th of February 1872, and when passing through Constantinople, he made the acquaintance of the Prime Minister of Egypt, Raghib Pasha. The Egyptian Prime Minister opened negotiations for Gordon to serve under the Ottoman Khedive Ismail Pasha, who was popularly called Ismail the Magnificent on the account of his lavish spending. And after meeting Gordon in 1874, the Khedive Ismail said, "What an extraordinary Englishman. He doesn't want any money." Rather interesting. And we learn from this that Britain is on good terms with the Ottoman Empire at this time, 1872. Do you know much about that, when Britain was on good terms with the Ottomans, Max, about this time, 1872?
I'm not particularly aware of any in-depth detail, just really that it was a sort of situation of our enemy's enemy is our friend, and we were struggling to contain the burgeoning Russian Empire at the time, where the Russians were expanding down through the Caucasus and down through Central Asia towards Afghanistan, and that's during that period the British government must have seen the Ottomans as an ally against Russia.
Well, yeah, because he ends up working for them for quite a while. The French-educated Ismail Pasha greatly admired Europe as the model for excellence in everything, being an especially passionate Italophile and Francophile, saying at the beginning of his reign, "My country is no longer in Africa, it is now in Europe." And we see the same thing with Turkey, don't we? Turkey thinking that it is now in Europe, just because it's become a little bit more civilized. Ismail was a Muslim who loved Italian wine and French champagne, and many of his more conservative subjects in Egypt and the Sudan felt alienated by a regime that was determined to westernize the country with little regard for tradition. And the languages of Khedive's court were Turkish and French, and not Arabic. And again, drinking alcohol, that's legal in Turkey as well, and not in the other Islamic countries. So I should imagine Egypt was fairly much, well, trying to be like Turkey at this time. Do you know much about Egypt at this time, Max, or Turkey?
Well, there were, during the 1800s and the early part of and the 20th century, basically, there were two threads running through the Arab world, one of which was Arab nationalism, which tended to be secular and which tended to want to copy the best of what it saw within the European nations. And the second thread was the Islamic movement, and where they were trying to establish a caliphate that would be an Islamic caliphate. And so on the one hand, you've got the kind of radical Arab Islamists who want to create a caliphate. And then on the other hand, you've got the Arab nationalists. And these extended even into the late 20th century, where you had people like Saddam Hussein, who was an Arab nationalist, who tried to create a secular Iraq. You have Bashar al-Assad in Syria, who has tried to create a secular society there, albeit that they do tolerate the religions that exist. And I think the same thing existed in Egypt as well.
Well, we'll see later on that we see this other force, the Islamic State. There was an equivalent of today's Islamic State that was actually taking place there at the same time. So, yeah, as you're saying there, Max, with these two different forces of Islam, the progressive Islam that was on the side of the nationalists, and then the fundamentalist Islam that was wanting to set up a caliphate and have the strictest Sharia law possible, exactly the same as ISIS today. Well, the Khedive's great dream was to make Egypt culturally a part of Europe, and he spent huge sums of money attempting to modernize and westernize Egypt, in the process going very deeply into debt. At the beginning of his reign in 1863, Egypt's debt had been 3 million in Egyptian pounds, but when Ismail's reign ended in 1879, Egypt's debt had risen to 93 million pounds. I mean, that's a huge amount that it's increased by there, about 30 times. The Khedive asked for Gordon to be made governor of Equatoria province, that comprised much of what is today South Sudan and northern Uganda. Ismail Pasha told Gordon that he wished to expand Equatoria into the rest of Uganda with the ultimate aim of absorbing the entire Great Lakes region of East Africa into the empire that Ismail wanted to build in Africa. The former Governor Baker's annual salary as Governor of Equatoria had been 10,000 Egyptian pounds, almost $1 million in today's money. And Ismail was astonished when Gordon refused that salary, saying that £2,000 per year was more than enough for him. So he only wanted to take 20% of what the governor had had before. And again, this shows you how much in demand British officers were and men from the British Empire were in these other countries, because this is a country that's run by the Ottomans and they want this British guy there as the governor, because they know he's not going to be corrupt, unlike the Turks and the Egyptians. Do you want to comment on any of this, Max?
No, I think that's a very sort of clear point that comes out of it. Yes, and it's also illustrative of the sort of ambitions that the Egyptians had at the time. Really, that they wanted to expand the empire down into Africa, and that they wanted to be seen as European rather than African.
I think it describes a lot of the way that the countries in the British Empire felt. You know, they felt very privileged and they wanted to be like Europe. They didn't see it as, oh, we're being oppressed by these horrible British people. The majority of them were very welcoming and very pleased that they were having all the gifts of civilization being brought to them. And they had access to trade and all the things that were being built and created all around the British Empire. It was seen as a positive thing. You wanted to have the British Empire there. They would treat you better than your own people would treat you, as we learned in China. Well, after a short stay in Cairo, Gordon proceeded to Khartoum in Sudan via Suakin and Berber. In Khartoum, Gordon attended a dinner with the Governor General, Ismail Ayub Pasha, being entertained by barely dressed belly dancers, whom one of Gordon's officers drunkenly attempted to have sex with, leading to a disgusted Gordon walking out, saying that he was shocked that Ayub allowed these things to happen in his palace. So again, we see the virtuous Gordon here. He's not happy with this Muslim behaving like this. And he's not happy with his officer either for doing that. I'm surprised they didn't attack the officer, to be honest, for doing something like that. Wouldn't you think?
Well, I suppose he would have attacked the officer had the officer been actually raping the woman, but according to the account you've given here, the woman might actually have been a willing participant, in which case it's just debauchery as opposed to criminal.
Yeah, I guess it could have led to quite a diplomatic scene. That's quite serious. During his time in Sudan, Gordon was much involved in attempting to suppress the slave trade while struggling against a corrupt and inefficient Egyptian bureaucracy that had no interest in suppressing it. Gordon soon learned that his superior, the Governor General of the Sudan, Ismail Ayub Pasha, was deeply involved in the slave trade and doing everything within his power to sabotage Gordon's anti-slavery work by denying him supplies and leaking information to the slavers. Again, this shows us that what we were up against in the British Empire, trying to stop slavery. All the blacks in Africa, they did not want to see slavery stopped. They were the ones that wanted slavery to continue, and the Arabs. It was the white British that didn't want it to continue, and the black Africans and the Arabs were doing all they could to sabotage our efforts to stop slavery, basically. You know, it's the opposite of what we're taught today. Gordon, despite his position as an official in the Ottoman Empire, found the Ottoman-Egyptian system of rule inherently oppressive and cruel, coming into increasing conflict with the very system he was supposed to uphold. Later, stating about his time in the Sudan, "I taught the natives they had a right to exist." In the Ottoman Empire, power was exercised via a system of institutionalized corruption, where officials looted their provinces via heavy taxes and by demanding kickbacks known as bakshish. Some of the money went to Constantinople, with the rest pocketed by the officials. Again, this is the system that the British Empire was putting a stop to. All of this institutionalized corruption that was going on. And he's telling the natives they have a right to exist. This man is caring about the natives. He's not oppressing them. This whole narrative of the British Empire oppressing the natives is bunkum. Gordon established a close rapport with the African peoples of Equatoria, such as the Nuer and the Dinka, who had long suffered from the activity of Arab slave traders and who naturally supported Gordon's efforts to stamp out the trade. The peoples of Equatoria had traditionally worshipped spirits present in nature, but were steadily being converted to Christianity by missionaries from Europe and the United States, which further encouraged Gordon in his efforts as governor of Equatoria, who, notwithstanding his position working for the Egyptian government, saw himself as doing God's work there. I'm not sure if the Dinka tribe still exist, but again, it shows you that was the economy in Africa was slavery, basically, and it was very hard to stop.
Yeah, and I think that what it shows is that although the Ottoman system of government is could be sort of equated with a kind of a feudal system in which the local pasha extorts money from the tribes and the common people under his control, and then passes on some of that money further up the chain to the sort of a national level and to an imperial level. The feudal system existed there rather than being paternalistic in the way in which the feudal system was applied in Europe, tended to be tyrannical in the sense that it was purely used to milk money out of people irrespective of whether the milking of the money in that way was doing them harm or not.
Oh, it's totally tyrannical. They certainly didn't really look on these people as even being other humans, really. They just looked at them as resources that they could use and abuse. And you've got Gordon here who's saying, well, you know, you have a right to exist. You have a right to go about your lives. You know, you shouldn't be enslaved by these other peoples just because you're not as big as they are. I think the Dinka were one of these small in stature tribes. Well, Gordon was not impressed with the forces of the Egyptian state. The soldiers of the Egyptian army were fellahin, peasant conscripts who were both ill-paid and ill-trained. The other force for law and order were the much-feared Bashi Bazouks, irregulars who were not paid a salary but were expected to support themselves by looting. The Bashi Bazouks were extremely susceptible to corruption and were notorious for their brutality, especially to non-Muslims. So again, we see the treatment of non-Muslims. They're considered to be different to Muslims. And we see that this is just like China. And these people are expected to just loot and pillage rather than actually being paid a salary. Well, Gordon himself often personally intercepted the slave convoys to arrest the slavers and break the chains of the slaves. But he found that the corrupt Egyptian bureaucrats usually then sold the freed Africans back into slavery. And the expense of caring for thousands of freed slaves who were a long way from home was burdensome. He eventually came into conflict with the Egyptian governor of Khartoum and Sudan over his efforts to ban the trade. This clash led to Gordon informing the Khedive that he did not wish to return to the Sudan, and he left for London. And during his time in London, he was approached by Sir William MacKinnon, an enterprising Scottish shipowner who had gone into partnership with King Leopold II of the Belgians with the aim of creating a chartered company that would conquer Central Africa, and they wished to employ Gordon as their agent in Africa. He accepted their offer, believing rather naively in Leopold's and MacKinnon's assurances that their plans were purely philanthropic and they had no interest in exploiting Africans for profit. But the Khedive, Ismail Pasha, wrote to him saying that he had promised to return and that he expected him to keep his word. Gordon agreed to return to Cairo and was asked to take the position of Governor General of the entire Sudan, which he accepted, and he now received the honorific rank and title of Pasha in the Ottoman aristocracy. So he's gone from being a general in the British Army, he's now, and then he was Chinese Gordon in China. And now he's a pasha in the Ottoman aristocracy. He's high up in the Ottomans, and he's fighting against the slave trade and really having problems with doing that. I mean, imagine that you're freeing these slaves, and then your superiors, when you send them to your superiors to send them on the train back to where they came from in Africa, your superiors are then selling them back into slavery.
Yeah, amazing, isn't it?
This is what we were up against. I mean, it's incredible. It's just the opposite of everything that we're told about the British Empire, don't you think?
The traditional narrative nowadays is a travesty of the truth.
Anyway, let's get into our greatest Britons, a man who did make some great accomplishments in his life. General Gordon. We'll start with a recap from last week. We talked about his charity work when he came back into Britain, about how he gave away 90% of his annual income. We talked about how he never married, which in actual fact was quite common at the time. And you pointed out after we'd actually finished recording, Max, that, Tesla didn't marry, Hitler didn't marry until right at the end, Rhodes didn't marry, and Lord Baden-Powell didn't actually marry until he was 65. And then he sired three children. So this shows us that being celibate was something that was actually quite common. It wasn't uncommon. It didn't mean that somebody was homosexual at all, because we've had these modern accusations that a lot of these people were homosexual simply because they were celibate. And you also pointed out, Max, that the gays would have remained celibate anyway back then if they knew that they had these perverted desires, which is how it would have been seen back then they would have just done all they could to avoid any of those kinds of situations, and they would have been celibate. So the idea that he was homosexual is just really just an insult. We talked about how he rescued a girl from the Ottoman Pashas in Bulgaria, and one of our Bulgarian listeners was unable to find out more information about that, so it's obviously not a national myth or anything that's talked about now. And then we talked about how he was in Egypt and he was promoted to colonel and he was made the governor of Equatoria. And once he was made the governor of Equatoria, he really fought against the slave trade. And this was despite his superiors who were supporting it. And every time that he freed these slaves and sent them back so that they could then be sent back to where they originally came from, his superiors were then enslaving them again and selling them on again. And this really shows us what the British Empire's role in the world was. It was trying to make life better for the peoples of these third world countries. It wasn't about oppressing them. It was about trying to do away with the corruption that was actually in these nations. I don't know if you want to add any more to that, Max, or anything that you want to bring up to do with that.
Well, I think your recollection of the conversation we had last week is absolutely spot on. I think in times gone by, sexuality and aspects of sex were not as central to the culture that existed, certainly back in the early part of the 20th century and earlier than that. And so therefore, if a man found that he was going to lead a life that would require him to place his life in danger on a regular basis, and where he would not be able to lead a normal life such that it would be conducive to married life, then men quite often would just defer getting married, or would decide not to get married, and they would pursue their career in order to make their mark in history. And then only once they had done that would they then perhaps look around in the way that Lord Baden-Powell did, and think, well, you know, am I too late to have a family and to enter into married life, or am I not? And in the case of Lord Baden-Powell, he decided that he wasn't too late, and he married at what most people would regard as quite an advanced age, at something like 65 years of age. And as you report, you know, he did father three children beyond that, which shows that he was, even at the age of 65, still a very virile man and somebody who was a virile heterosexual rather than a homosexual. And so when people turn around and they say, oh, so-and-so in, you know, that era in time had remained celibate throughout the whole of their life, it doesn't indicate that there is anything more sort of obscure that you need to sort of look for to explain that. It is just something that men did because of the needs of their time. And I think even as far as Hitler is concerned, Hitler wrote in Mein Kampf that he had never married for two reasons really. And the one reason was that he felt that the fact that he was single created a greater attraction for women in him, but also that secondly, the life he led was so dangerous that it wouldn't have been conducive to married life, and it would have weakened his position And it would have placed anybody that was very close to him, a wife or children, it would have placed them in danger. And so that's why he remained a single man for as long as he did.
We have to be careful not to project today's sensibilities really on the past. There's good points there that you bring up, Max. Mm. Gordon then headed back to London, and he was asked to work for King Leopold of Belgium in the Congo, but he's persuaded to head back to the Sudan by the rich Khedive Ismail Pasha, who was this very rich person that actually got his country into a lot of debt, and we'll find out more about him in today's episode. Gordon agreed to return to Cairo and was asked to take the position of Governor General of the entire Sudan, which he accepted, and he now received the honorific rank and title of Pasha in the Ottoman aristocracy. And as governor, Gordon faced a variety of challenges. Besides working to end slavery, Gordon carried out a series of reforms, such as abolishing torture and public floggings, where those opposed to the Egyptian state were flogged with a whip known as the courbash, made of buffalo hide. The reforms that Gordon wanted would have changed the basic nature of the Ottoman-Egyptian rule by replacing a system based on exploitation of the people by the state with one where the state would work for the betterment of the people. These aims unfortunately eluded him, however. Gordon himself was honest and incorruptible, but he was almost alone in possessing those qualities. And the venal and corrupt Egyptian bureaucrats usually ignored his orders when they conflicted with the chance to make a quick buck. Unfortunately, most of the Europeans who the Egyptians had hired to work as civil servants in the Sudan were no better and proved to be just as corrupt as the Egyptians. The bribes that the slave traders offered for bureaucrats to turn a blind eye to the slave trade had far more effect on the bureaucrats than did any of Gordon's offers to suppress the slave trade, which were simply ignored. Lisergio Santoni, an Italian hired by the Egyptian state to run the Sudanese post office, wrote about Gordon's time as Governor General that, as his exertions were not supported by his subordinates, his efforts remained fruitless. This man's activity with the scientific knowledge which he possesses is doubtless able to achieve much, but unfortunately no one backs him up, and his orders are badly carried out or altered in such a way as to render them without effect. All the Europeans, with some rare exceptions, whom he has honoured with his confidence, have cheated him. Reflecting these realities, Gordon had to undertake much of the administrative work himself, travelling ceaselessly and constantly all over the Sudan via a camel in attempts to make the bureaucracy actually obey his orders, something that occurred when he was present but stopped as soon as he left. Gordon was as well known for being utterly obstinate as he was for riding his camel, joking that the Gordons and the camels are of the same race. Let them take an idea into their heads and nothing will take it out. I have a splendid camel, none like it. It flies along and quite astonishes the Arabs. Gordon's reforming zeal would make him popular with the ordinary people of the Sudan. As one observer noted, whenever he left and entered the governor's palace in Khartoum, government officials, consular agents and native people awaited him in large numbers, and they celebrated His Excellency's arrival with an indescribable uproar. So we see a man there that is really popular with the people, and he's trying to do his best by these people, and that they're not his own people. These are the Sudanese and these are the Arabs, and unfortunately the actual people that he's working for are just too corrupt, and they're not helping him out in any way. I mean, this must have been really soul-destroying for him, trying to get rid of this slave trade, this horrific slave trade, and the bureaucrats just keep turning a blind eye to it, and he's been employed to actually do this. He's not even taking his full wage. He's only taking about 20% of the wages that he was actually offered for this. He's doing it out of a love of humanity, really, and he's just not getting anywhere with it. And he does manage to abolish torture and public floggings, which is good. But again, that's something that we still see that goes on today in Saudi Arabia. You know, what was going on back then under Ottoman Egyptian rule is the same sort of thing that we see today still happening in these Muslim countries. And all this time we've wanted to put a stop to it. There have been good British people, good British men that have gone out there in the British Empire trying to make life better for the people that they were ruling over. They were not out there to oppress them. Do you have any thoughts on Gordon here in Sudan, Max?
Well, I think we said last week, or it might have been the week before when we were talking about Gordon, that he kind of exhibited the characteristics that one would hope to have in a king. And I think that he's the sort of person who, had he been a self-serving person, he could have established himself as a king in somewhere like China, where he served for a while, but also he would appear to have been able to have established himself as a king in the Sudan as well, had he been somebody who was promoting his own personal self-interest. But, you know, quite clearly, he was one of the people who believed that the administration that was provided by the British Empire under the British system of government that prevailed at the time, which was, in comparison with today, largely uncorruptible, that he firmly believed that that was in the interests of the people that were under his sway, and he behaved in a thoroughly upstanding way, and in a way which was in the best interest of the people who were in his care. And the point is that it's ironic that nowadays, with the likes of Black Lives Matter, etc., that he would be the kind of person where they would campaign to have his statue torn down, and they would beat his statue with clubs and rocks in order to deface it and throw it in the river if they had the opportunity. And yet he is the sort of person that really ought to be celebrated as an almost saintly personality, in my view.
He should really be lionized and also put up as an example of this is what people were like in the British Empire. Yes, there were some corrupt people, but there were also very good people. And we'll see in this next bit that as well as looking out for the best interests of the natives, he was also against the banks. In 1876, Egypt went bankrupt. A group of European financial commissioners led by Evelyn Baring, so he must be from Baring's bank, I take it, took charge of the Egyptian finances in an attempt to pay off the European banks who had lent so much money to Egypt. With the country bankrupt, the money to carry out the reforms Gordon wanted just was not there. With over half of Egypt's income going to pay the 7% interest on the debt worth 81 million Egyptian pounds that Ishmael had run up, the Khedive was supportive of Gordon's plans for reform, but unable to do very much, as he lacked the money to pay his civil servants and soldiers in Egypt, much less so in the Sudan. Gordon travelled north to Cairo to meet with Baring and suggest a solution that Egypt suspend its interest payments for several years to allow Ishmael to pay the arrears owed to his soldiers and civil servants, arguing that once the Egyptian government was stabilised, then Egypt could start paying its debts without fear of causing a revolution. Gordon's plans were far-sighted and humane. But Baring had no interest in Gordon's plans to suspend the interest payments, being a typical banker. Gordon disliked Baring, writing that he had a pretentious, grand, patronising way around him. We had a few words together. When oil mixes with water, we will mix together. So, see, Gordon's got quite a sensible idea here. You don't want this country to fall to Islamic radicals. You don't want there to be a civil war. You're not going to get your money back if it becomes a failed state. The thing to do is to just suspend the interest on the debt. But the bankers don't want to do that because they want to take everything. They want to take all the property, everything that was put up as collateral on the debt. They want to own the country. What we see today, we see the World Bank and the IMF telling these countries that they loan to that they have to bring in human rights, they have to promote homosexuality, they have to promote diversity, they have to tax the middle classes. All these things that we see that are harmful are being forced on these countries by the World Bank and the IMF in exchange for this money that they actually loan to them. And we see here that the way the banks make their money is purely out of this interest. And half the money from Egypt, half the gross domestic product that was created by Egypt was all having to go just on the interest of this debt, and that was just a 7% interest, and it was taking up half of all the money that the country could produce. So you can see that there is this incentive there for them to keep up the slavery, really, because they've got to try and make the money somehow. And that was the main way of making money in Africa. So you can see why they didn't want to give up slavery. They got these huge debts to the banks. And what else is there that they can produce other than other slaves? So you got quite a situation there. And I do like the fact that he didn't get on with the bankers, and he had this good idea. Max, yeah. Comment on this?
No, I thoroughly agree with what you said there, actually. I believe it exactly the way to interpret what you've just recounted. And it is, again, another feather in Gordon's cap that he did try to resist the bankers, and he wasn't prepared to see Egypt impoverished just simply in the interests of the banks.
Yeah, he knew what would happen if the civil servants weren't paid and if the army weren't paid. You would get chaos and you would get a failed state. Well, slavery was the basis of the Sudanese economy, and Gordon's attempts to end the slave trade meant taking on some very powerful vested interests, most notably Rahama Zobir, known as the King of the Slavers, as he was the richest and most powerful of all the slave traders in the entire Sudan. An insurrection had broken out in Darfur province, led by associates of Zobir, and Gordon went to deal with it. The insurgents were numerous, and he saw that diplomacy had a better chance of success. On the 2nd of September 1877, Gordon, clad in the full gold braided ceremonial blue uniform of the Governor General of the Sudan, and wearing the tarbrush, the type of fez reserved for a pasha, accompanied by an interpreter and a few bashi bazooks, he rode unannounced right into the enemy camp to discuss the situation. Gordon carried no weapons except for his rattan cane, although the bashi bazooks were armed with rifles and swords, but showed absolutely no fear, while his interpreter and the bashi bazooks were visibly showing their nerves as the rebels numbered about 3,000. Gordon was met by Suleiman Zobir, the son of Rahama Zobir, and demanded in the name of the Khedive of Egypt that the rebels end their rebellion and accept the authority of their lord and master, telling Zobir that he would disarm and break them if the rebellion did not end at once. Gordon also promised that those rebels who laid down their arms would not be punished and would all be given jobs in the administration. A tense standoff ensued, and though the rebels could have easily killed Gordon and his party, as Gordon wrote in a letter to his sister, the rebels were all dumbfounded at my coming among them. This bold move proved successful, as one chief and then another pledged his loyalty to the Khedive, including Suleiman Zobir himself, although the remainder retreated to the south. Zobir the slaver would later turn renegade, though, and on the 15th of July 1879, Gordon's associate Gessi finally captured Zobir together with 250 of his men. As Zobir had broken his oath to the Khedive by rebelling, Gordon gave Gessi orders to execute Zobir, and later that day Gessi had Zobir and his men publicly beheaded as an example of what happened to those men who broke their oaths. So again, we see his courage there, going in there completely unarmed and deciding that the diplomacy is the way to deal with this, British diplomacy, to avoid a massacre, and then taking these people on in the administration. They were obviously business-minded, even if what they were involved in was the slave trade. I'm sure they probably would have been quite good at working in the administration here. And again, we see the importance of keeping to your oath. And all these men were publicly beheaded for breaking their oath as well. And you can see he's got a huge reputation now, hasn't he? And he could have made himself right. King.
Yeah, I mean, to go in amongst them unarmed in the way that he did basically demonstrated that he had tremendous confidence in his ability to resist any kind of attack that they might throw against him, and that obviously unnerved them, and that's the reason why a number of them immediately pledged their loyalty to the Khedive.
Oh, yeah, he must have had a huge sense of authority. Well, Gordon then tried another peace mission to Abyssinia, which was at war with Egypt. The matter ended with Gordon's imprisonment and transfer to Massawa. From there, he returned to Cairo and resigned his Sudan appointment, being exhausted by years of incessant work. Gordon had gone to the Sudan with high hopes that via his iron will and Christian faith, he would defeat the Ottoman-Egyptian system of rule, that he would act as a reformer who would change the system from within to make what was unjust just, and that he would make things better for the ordinary people of the Sudan. Instead, the Ottoman-Egyptian system had defeated him, with almost all of Gordon's reforms having failed owing to the venality of the bureaucracy, who shared absolutely none of Gordon's moral outrage at slavery and injustice, and Gordon's dreams of making things better for the ordinary people were dissolved in the face of greed and the self-interest of others. The system remained the same, creaking, slow, utterly corrupt, an oppressive apparatus, trampling down ordinary people the same as it had always been. At the end of his governor generalship of the Sudan, Gordon had to admit that he had been a failure, an experience of defeat that so shattered him that he had a nervous breakdown. As he travelled via Egypt to take the steamer back to Britain, a man who met him in Cairo described Gordon as a broken man who was rather off his head. Before Gordon boarded the ship at Alexandria that was to take him home, he sent off a series of long telegrams to various ministers in London, full of biblical verses and quotations that he claimed offered the solution to all of the problems of modern life. I think possibly part of this breakdown could have been caused by his imprisonment, because that must have been pretty harsh, being imprisoned when he went to Abyssinia to try and make peace between Abyssinia and Egypt. You would hope that he would be treated like, you know, respectfully as the pasha that he was, high up in the Ottoman Empire. But you just don't know, do you, with these prisons there? And obviously, it must have really, really hurt him that he had done all this work, and he's got all these, you know, he's done so many good deeds, and he's got such a good moral character, and he just wants to do the best for these people, and it just all failed. Unfortunately, do you want to add anything to that, Max?
Well, just really that one man can't necessarily take on an entire system and reform the system. That it very often takes other people to join them, and in order to make their reforms work. And I think this is sort of fairly clear in this particular instance.
Yeah, you can only do so much if you're on your own. You've got to have the rest of the people working with you rather than against you. Well, after recovering and turning down various positions, he was invited to Beijing by Sir Robert Hart, the Inspector General of Customs in China, saying his services were urgently needed in China as Russia and China were on the verge of war. Gordon was nostalgic for China, and knowing of the Sino-Russian crisis, he saw a chance to do something significant. The British diplomat Thomas Francis Wade reported, "The Chinese government still holds Gordon Pasha in high regard, and they were anxious to have him back to fight against Russia if war should break out." An exchange of telegrams ensued between the War Office in London and Gordon in Bombay about just what exactly he was planning on doing in China, and when Gordon replied that he would find out when he got there, Gordon was ordered to stay. Gordon then disobeyed orders and left on the first ship to China, an action that very much angered the army's commander, the Duke of Cambridge. Gordon arrived in Shanghai in July and met Li Hongzhang and learned that there was a risk of war with Russia. After meeting his old friend, Gordon assured Li that if Russia should attack, he would resign his commission in the British army to take up a commission in the Chinese army, an action that, if taken, risked prosecution under the Foreign Enlistments Act. Gordon informed the Foreign Office that he was willing to renounce his British citizenship and take Chinese citizenship, as he would not abandon Li and his other Chinese friends should a Sino-Russian war begin. Gordon's willingness to renounce his British citizenship in order to fight with China in the event of war did much to raise his prestige in China. He proceeded to Beijing, where he clashed repeatedly with Prince Chun, the leader of the war party, who rejected Gordon's advice to seek a compromise solution, as Gordon warned that the powerful Russian naval squadron in the Yellow Sea would allow the Russians to land at Tianjin and advance on Beijing. At one point during a meeting with the Council of Ministers, an enraged Gordon picked up a Chinese-English dictionary, looked up the word idiocy, and then pointed at the equivalent Chinese word with one hand while pointing at the ministers with the other. Gordon further advised the King Court that it was unwise for the Manchu elite to live apart from and treat the Han Chinese majority as something less than human, warning that this not only weakened China in the present, but would cause a revolution in the future. After speaking so bluntly, Gordon was ordered out of the court and Beijing, but he was allowed to stay at Tianjin. He was then ordered home by London, as the Foreign Office was not comfortable with the idea of him commanding the Chinese army against Russia if war should break out, believing that this could cause an Anglo-Russian war, and Gordon was told that he would be dishonorably discharged if he remained in China. Though the King Court rejected Gordon's advice to seek a compromise with Russia in the summer of 1880, Gordon's assessment of China's military backwardness and his stark warnings that the Russians would win if a war did break out played an important role in ultimately strengthening the peace party at the court, and it did prevent war from breaking out. So you see there that, he's pushing for diplomacy rather than for war, and he's got his loyalties to these Chinese people here. I mean, hard to say whether that's right to say that he would resign his citizenship from Britain to go and help with the Chinese, but I guess morally he saw that that was the right thing to do.
I guess he saw that there was no pressing threat to Britain at that point in time, whereas there was a pressing threat to China and the people that he had built up a link and obviously an affection for.
And it wasn't just the Chinese and the Sudanese that he cared about. He also had an incident in Ireland. When Gordon returned to Britain in October 1880, he paid a two-week visit to Ireland, landing at Cork and travelling over much of the island. He was sickened by the poverty of the Irish farmers, which led him to write a six-page memo to the Prime Minister, William Gladstone, urging land reforms in Ireland. Gordon wrote, "The peasantry of the northwest and southwest of Ireland are much worse off than any of the inhabitants of Bulgaria, Asia Minor, China, India, or the Sudan." Having been to all of those places and thus speaking with some authority, Gordon announced the scandal of poverty in Ireland could only be ended if the government were to buy the land of the ascendancy families, as the Anglo-Irish elite was known, and give it to the poor Irish tenant farmers. Gordon compared his plans for rural reform in Ireland to ending slavery in the British Empire in 1833, and ended his letter with the claim that if this was done, the unity of the United Kingdom would be preserved, as the Irish would appreciate this great act of justice, and the Irish independence movement would cease to exist, as they would have nothing more to seek from agitation. Somewhat tactlessly, Gordon reminded Gladstone that his father had owned a slave plantation in Jamaica and had been one of those slave owners compensated by the Crown in 1833 for the freeing of his slaves, a bit of Gladstone family history that the Prime Minister did not like to have discussed. So again, he's saying a lot of sensible things here. And you look at all the problems that we've had in Ireland and Northern Ireland ever since. And this really shows you how badly the Irish were treated. If he's saying that they were far worse off than the inhabitants of the Sudan, India, China, Bulgaria and Asia Minor, then they must have been in a very bad way. What do you make of Gordon in Ireland here, Max?
Well, I would say that it's tragic, really, that nobody took any notice of him at that particular point in time. And because when you consider the problems that the Troubles have created, when you consider that the weakening of Britain as a result of losing Southern Ireland, and also the weakening of our position internationally and in terms of our ability to bargain with the European Union as a result of losing Southern Ireland and having Southern Ireland become be allied to the rest of Europe against Britain, that is a massive loss to us as a nation, and it's something which had only Gladstone been prepared to listen to Gordon and had taken an interest in what Gordon was saying, then all of that could have been averted, and we might find ourselves today in a much, much stronger position.
Yeah, Gladstone really doesn't sound too good, as we'll see in the next episode. He has a big run-in with Gladstone, and really, I think what happened to Gordon could have been responsible for the end of Gladstone. But we can see here that he's already got off on the wrong foot with him by reminding him that his money came from slave plantations, and that the slave masters were paid out. They were paid for, so why won't they pay out the Anglo-Irish elite and buy the lands from them in the same way that they bought the slaves from the people in America. Again, it's the same thing as a lot of people have pointed out. Why were the British so concerned with the treatment of the blacks in America and not concerned with the treatment of essentially white slavery that was going on in Britain at the time? Why was that? Yeah. And that's what Gordon is really pointing out there by highlighting Gladstone's links to slavery. Well, next week we will get into Gordon's war against the Islamic State.
And of course, the next episode in our Greatest Britain series will be part two of Major General Charles Gordon. And of course, we look forward to seeing you again once that one has been published.